You're listening to Around Comics, episode 110. Roundtable discussing topics in and around the world of comics. I'm your host, Christopher Niesman, and I'm joined by the co-host of the show, Mr. Brian Salazar.
I am the Dark Knight of podcasting. I've proclaimed myself.
That's quite a statement.
Well, I have returned.
It's a good thing that you're the Dark Knight of podcasting, because this episode is our spotlight on the career of one Mr. Frank Miller.
Frank, did you want me to? I have nothing to say there. I don't know. Yes, it is.
You'll have plenty to say about Frank Miller, because I know what a huge fan you are.
Yeah,
he is one of the true legends in comics, and all you have to do is look at his library of work to see that. And if your home library is lacking some of the major works of Frank Miller,
not me.
Now is a great time to let you know that this episode of Around Comics is sponsored by InStockTrades.com.
InStockTrades.com is your source for all things Frank Miller. Check out Frank Miller's landmark run on Daredevil in the Daredevil Omnibus. They also carry Batman The Dark Knight Returns, The Dark Knight Strikes Again, Ronin, Sin City, and many others. InStockTrades.com is your source for trade paperbacks, deluxe hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more. All at great discounted prices. And remember that all orders over $50 ship for free.
Remember that Around Comics is recorded every Friday at 7 o'clock at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles.
Remember.
Located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you're in the area, please drop by. We would love to meet you.
Open your mind.
Would also like to mention Tom is not here this week. He'll be back. He'll be back again on Monday.
Where is Tom?
You know,
any idea?
He was pretty vague about it.
Yeah, he was mysterious.
Tom's not here. Scotty's not here.
We know where Scotty's at. He's in Charlotte.
I think
North Carolina.
Tom is away fighting crime.
You know, whenever I'm gone, it's like some lame, you know, thing. But Tom, it's like he's on, you know, on.
You're at like your daughter's dance
recital. Yeah, and Tom's fighting crime or on
assignment.
On assignment, yeah.
Yes, Tom is on assignment finding our next creator spotlight.
There you go.
Well, I tell you what, let's move on. It is time for Around Comics Creator Spotlight on Frank Miller. Discussing the incredible career of Frank Miller. We'll cover all of his major works and talk about their place in comics history. Along the way, we're going to hear from some of Frank Miller's contemporaries, creators he's inspired, and fans of his work. Born in 1957 in Maryland and raised in Vermont, Frank Miller was a comic fan and from an early age aspired to be a comic artist. His first published work was in The Twilight Zone for Gold Key Comics in 1978. It was at Marvel that Miller would settle in as a regular fill-in and cover artist, including drawing Spectacular Spider-Man number 27 and 28. Here, John Byrne recalls young Frank Miller at Marvel.
Frank was the young Turk who reminded me that I wasn't a young Turk anymore when he came along. It was I was kind of looking over my shoulder and saying, what's that cloud of dust coming up so fast behind me? Because he just really did explode on the scene. And it was kind of interesting because he and I had oddly parallel moments in our careers where we both kind of got to a point where we weren't having as much fun working with particular writers as we had, and had decided we could probably write our own stuff. And he and I actually talked about that, because I'd gone down the path a little bit before he had, and I was very much encouraging him to strike out on his own. And I remember I said to him at one point that if he was going to knock me out of the top box, I was damn well going to help him do it.
And you know, that's really an interesting thing to hear. Someone like John Byrne, with obviously the amount of respect he has for Frank, a guy that came up, behind him, but who, you know, for whatever you will say about John Byrne, I mean, he can't deny he couldn't deny the talent.
And you're going to hear that repeatedly throughout this episode, the amount of respect that John Byrne has for Frank Miller as a creator. And I think that's a very mutual respect from every account that I've heard.
I've been reading over the last week or so, trying to prepare for this show and everything. I was reading the Eisner Miller book that's come out. It's a interview, basically the entire book is an interview conducted by Charles Brownstein, and it's much more of a conversation than like a straight interview. You don't ever see the questions being posed. It's just them talking. They're good friends, and in it he mentions John Byrne a few times, and you can tell just in the small glimpses in there that he obviously had respect for John. So
when that aired, they were two of a very small group of what you would call superstar creators in comics.
Sure. Well, John was really the first. I mean, superstar. I mean, maybe Neil Adams before him, but I don't know that Adams had the notoriety outside of the industry.
I think the industry had grown to a point that it was able to actually have, you know, the quote-unquote superstars, mm-hmm. and Frank Miller was a comet that kind of, you know, streaked into that environment, and a lot of that started from his first major work at Marvel, which in May of 1979, Miller began work on a series that would define his early career and redefine crime stories in the superhero genre. At first taking over penciling duties for the legendary Gene Colan, and then writing duties as well, Miller made Daredevil a street-level crime fighter in a darker and more complicated world. It was Miller's transformation of the Rogues Gallery that made one of the biggest impacts on a slumping series. From the acrobatic sharpshooter Bullseye to the once laughable Kingpin, Miller created a dense and psychologically frightening cast of villains to duel against Marvel's blind lawyer and protector of Hell's Kitchen.
And there, you know, he had started. I've always been a Daredevil fan since I've been reading comics. It's one of the few series that I've always stuck with, and really it was, you know, Miller was my introduction to Daredevil when those books were coming out. And I recently went back, and when the Omnibus came out, and I started reading that stuff over again. And, you know, when he first started, he was just the artist on it, with Roger McKenzie was scripting. And then soon afterwards, he took over the scripting duties also. And you can just tell, I would say immediately, the difference in tone that he had planned for Daredevil. It was something you hadn't really seen in Marvel Comics, specifically with Daredevil at all. And before that, Daredevil was very much like any other superhero book. Mm-hmm. He would fight all sorts of wacky villains and costume, you know, crimes, that kind of thing. But as soon as Miller took over, it was really what it seemed like to me is he limited the universe that Daredevil lived in. Even though he was in the Marvel Universe, he didn't have much interaction with a lot of the other characters. It was a very small cast throughout that entire initial run on Daredevil of, you know, the Kingpin and Gladiator and Bullseye and Elektra and the Hand. But that was pretty much it. I mean, there were a couple of issues where you saw some different characters, but not a whole lot, and it was a completely different vibe. He almost took him out of the regular Marvel universe and created this small little universe among himself in Hell's Kitchen. And it was very much Matt Murdock's world for just about the entire run that Frank did, and that obviously just built.
I think right off the bat, Miller started a trend that would follow him throughout his career. And it seems like as soon as he started writing that series, Daredevil as a comic grew up it got more mature. It, mm-hmm. it became more of an adult title, and then it seemed like the rest of the comics industry had to quickly catch up to what Miller was doing. And I think this is something that will, as we go through his career, we'll continue to see over and over again, that Miller would kind of punch through these walls, and then the rest of the comics industry would kind of scramble
try and
catch up. Right now we're going to hear once again from John Byrne on what it was like to have a very young Frank Miller working on Daredevil.
Well, that was one of the most amazing things about Frank. I remember that when he started writing Daredevil, there didn't seem to be any learning curve at all. It was like, bang, you know, he hit the ground running. And I just kind of stood back there going, you know, you son of a bitch, you know. I had to work at this, and you come in here, and there you are, suddenly a genius right out of the bag. That's not fair. It was just amazingly impressive to see him. And he was just a kid, you know, he was like 23. And it was just phenomenal. This little Frank Miller from Vermont or whatever it is, suddenly, you know, a shooter used to say he grew up, his best friend were trees, and suddenly he's writing all this gritty urban stuff, and it was just so phenomenal to see it happen, so impressive. Although I do remember that when he first moved to New York, he got himself a camera and went around crawling around on rooftops taking pictures in neighborhoods that nobody in their right mind would have gone anywhere near, but nobody bothered to tell him that nobody in their right mind would have gone anywhere near. So he went out and sort of immersed himself in the New York experience.
I think what's really really interesting about that last statement is when you're dealing with genius creators, and I don't think that there's much debate that Miller is a genius in the medium, that because you're so brilliant that they just kind of roll out of bed and great creations just kind of, like, you know, fall out of their head, and you kind of discount the amount of work that goes into it. And I think that truly great creations happen when you have a brilliant creator that also mixes an incredible work ethic. And I think that Miller is one of those really talented, gifted creators that always worked for, you know, for the craft, and you saw that, you know, crawling around on rooftops, taking pictures of the Manhattan rooftops and
yeah, and you know, we shouldn't discount his work, you know, in trying to grow and trying to improve his craft, because he did work while he started out with Daredevil very young. I mean, he was around the industry before that and worked very hard at improving. I know that you know, he, when he initially came to New York, he was, you know, shopping around, sort of a precursor to Sin City, and nobody wanted it. Nobody had any interest in it at that time. And then
it was too early.
Well, yeah, and you know, he worked with, you know, a lot of amazing artists and really studied and tried to do, you know, from all accounts, learn as much as he possibly could. He just was naturally gifted as being creative and able to come up with stuff that...
Sure. And I think also what you're looking at here is, it's maybe not the first wave of this type of creator. I think that really kind of happened more in the early 70s. But Frank Miller was a comic fan from a very early age, and he grew up knowing that he wanted to work in comics. Mm-hmm. And this was kind of that generation, kind of what I call almost the second generation of creators, where that first generation, you know, they did comics work almost because they had to.
Sure.
And now you had a generation of really, truly talented, creative people that wanted to work in the industry, and they
I don't even know at that time there were that many that... I mean, in the 40s and 50s, there were almost no one wanted to be a comic artist. I mean, it was... You know, they were doing that because they couldn't get illustration work. Couldn't get enough to pay the bills. And you had, maybe a couple of guys. You had Will Eisner, who was one guy that knew, you know, right away that he wanted to do this for the rest of his life. And Frank, you know, from all accounts, it seems, was the same way. That's what he wanted. He never thought of it as a road to something else. While it's led him to other places, comics was what it was always about from the very beginning. So I don't know how many other guys, even at the time he was breaking in, didn't have, you know, sort of the built-in...
passion.
Well, no, I think a lot of creators at the time, and he talks about this again in the book that I've been reading, about this sort of built-in insecurity about being a comic book artist, that because for so long comics have been regarded as a bastard art form, that so many creators, so many artists, so many writers in the industry for so long always felt insecure about the fact that they worked in that industry.
Wasn't a resume builder.
Exactly. And I think we're getting beyond that now, but even when he was coming, I don't know that he had that many people that were like, this is what I want to do. This is exactly what I want to do for the rest of my life. So,
sure. Well, I definitely want to make a note that Frank Miller's first issue on Daredevil was number 158, and then with the exception of issue 162, which was not drawn or written by him, he worked on the... on the series all the way to issue 191, mm-hmm. which that is really the meat of Miller's work on Daredevil until he would come back and work on it again
a decade later.
Yeah, which we'll talk about later.
And that chunk of work to me defined that character and made him what it is. To me, I will always think of those issues of what is what Daredevil is.
There's very few issues that I can right off the top of my head say this number did this. I mean, there's Amazing Fantasy 15.
Read that as a child?
Not as a child. But there are those few landmark issues that Detective 27, first appearances and that kind of stuff. Daredevil 181 is a landmark issue that really defined an era of comics with me, and that's the death of Elektra, and that is a masterpiece issue, and I think mm-hmm. that was really a climax of Miller's run on the first mega run that he did on Daredevil.
Yeah, well, I don't know. To me, it's just the entire body of work of it. It's just everything that he built up in the mythology of Daredevil and created that universe and created all those great supporting characters and really made the book more about Matt Murdock than necessarily about Daredevil and sort of the paradox between the two. And he just, to this day, I still think, there would not be the Bendis Daredevil. There wouldn't be the Brubaker Daredevil.
And he freely admitted it. Yeah, Bendis has said repeatedly the hardest thing of writing his run on Daredevil was that every issue he wanted to write a love letter
to
Miller and retread over the ground that he had gone on. Mm-hmm. That was the hardest thing, was to not do a rehash of Miller's Daredevil.
Right, because it is so... defining of that character. That
it made
hard
Kingpin
to get away from
one of the great villains in comics.
Absolutely.
He was, and I said in the introduction, he was a laughable character. He was really kind of known for just being fat and having funny henchmen mm-hmm. before Miller got a hold of that character. We could dedicate an entire episode to Frank Miller's run on Daredevil, but as amazing as his career has been, we need to move on. Near the completion of his first run on Daredevil, Miller would move his attention to another of Marvel's properties. This time, it wasn't a secondary character in need of an overhaul. This was Marvel's mutant bad boy, Wolverine. Miller and X-Men writer Chris Claremont would team up for the 4-issue Wolverine limited series, taking the adamantium clawed mutant away from his current cast and placing him in Japan. This series took a closer examination of the character and infused a samurai influence we would see in future Miller works. And here is John Byrne talking about Frank Miller's work on Wolverine.
At that particular period in his career, it seemed like Frank couldn't touch anything without it turning to gold. It was just amazing to see him work. And he stepped from Daredevil to Wolverine, who was a very different character. And just, it was like putting on a different pair of shoes. It was no big deal. He just, boom, did it. And it was just, again, it was brilliant. It was so impressive to watch him work.
And once again, it takes a character that was popular this time as opposed to a character that was not popular and did what many people still think is the defining, story of Wolverine. It created everything afterwards. It just sort of opened up the mythology of Wolverine and explored that character and made it possible for people to go in so many directions since then, and that's another reoccurring theme of Frank, is that he takes these characters that may have been around for a long time already and is able to look at them in a completely different way and tell a story that you've never seen yet everybody, you know, that reads it all of a sudden is just gravitates towards it, and you know, it becomes this defining work of that character. And we see it again later on, you know.
One of the things that he is, I think really, really great at is taking a character and just absolutely dismantling it. You know, if you think of it like a clock, he just takes all the different pieces apart and lays them out on the floor and says, okay, these are the great pieces of this mechanism, and that's what I'm going to focus on. And I'm going to put this back together, and I'm going to make it into something that's boiled down and more pure and really... really make it shine. And he does it with Daredevil. He does it with Wolverine. He does
it
with Batman.
I also think he has something that a lot of creators can't get past, is that he doesn't have the fear of changing them, of playing with them, of using them in a way that hasn't been done before. So much in comics forever and to this day is always based on what's gone before. And so many writers and artists are so afraid of breaking away from that. And I think rightfully so to some degree, because they're under the pressure of having to sell a monthly book and having their work liked by the editors and the companies that are publishing the work. But, you know, Frank, even at this early age, was not afraid of it. He, you know, with Daredevil, I think he had a little more leeway. It was like, you know, who cared about Daredevil at that time?
Daredevil was a bi-monthly book that had declining numbers, mm-hmm. and here you've got a young kid with showing some talent, as I'm imagining it, as at the Marvel offices, and it's like, yeah, you know what, let's try him out on this book, because you know what?
We got nothing to lose anyway.
If he fails, yeah, it's no loss. But now you try him out, not try him out, you know, he's obviously shown that he can handle the craft mm-hmm. and the medium, and then you put him on arguably the most popular character in comics.
Was he at that time, though? I don't know. I'm trying to think back. In 1982, was Wolverine that popular?
Yes.
Was Wolverine at that time? Okay. I'm just trying to...
Byrne had been off of X-Men, and it was really during Byrne's run that Wolverine became a mega icon in comics, and then... Frank Miller comes along, and I think that we always kind of look back at the Wolverine miniseries as when a really popular character became even more so. He went from being a really good character to a great character, and I still think the high point.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, he just has that ability to take it to the next level and not be afraid of sort of breaking it. You know, and sometimes that's always not worked out for him the best. A lot, you know, but most of the time it has, and it's just courage to do that. And I think an art, you know, for an artist, for whether you're a writer or a pencil or whatever, I mean, you have to have that in order to make something great. I mean, you can go a long ways in making good stuff and not ever maybe challenging yourself like that. Or challenging the norm.
I never got the feeling that Frank Miller was punching the clock on this stuff.
No, he wanted to push as far as he could and see how far, you know, it'll get him.
Sure. Well, one thing that Miller had shown that he could do at this point in his career was take existing characters and improve on them and make them better. But in July of 1983, we get to see really for the first time Miller creating his own world, creating his own cast of characters, both from an art and a writing side. And I think it's one of the really underappreciated works in the Miller catalog, and I think it is because it's not with a set of iconic characters, and that is the Ronin miniseries.
Yeah, Ronin's and if you go back to Daredevil and Wolverine, I mean, it had that Japanese influence, and Ronin was a samurai story. And Frank was really one of the first guys to incorporate any type of Japanese influence, manga influence. He was way ahead of the curve on that kind of thing.
Oh, by almost two decades.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? And you see it in, you know, in Daredevil, which ended up spawning, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and a whole host of...
And the Wolverine miniseries, I think, was a huge... Frank Miller. Without Frank Miller, there's no Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no question about that. It just... It inspired those guys to do that, and inspired, I mean, the whole sort of samurai and ninja and Japanese, you know, warfare aspect of comics that we saw come after that. I mean, he was really one of the first guys to ever even dabble in that, and you just saw it explode after that. And Ronin was another, you know, sort of step in that direction, but with a, you know, like I said, not established characters. This is all brand new stuff. And I was a big fan of Ronin when it first came out. I haven't reread it in a long time, so I don't know how it holds up. But at the time, what I remember from it was artistically, it was a departure from what we were used to seeing. And if you look at it now, probably a lot closer to what he does now sure. than what he was doing then.
I think it was the first major reinvention of his style, and I think that's part of the reason that it wasn't a major it was a critical success, but it wasn't a major commercial success at the time. And I think it's been one of those that has gained appreciation over the years. It was such a interesting creative story. It's really a futuristic story that feels very old at the same time.
Right.
And for him to balance those two very foreign worlds of feudal Japan and
sci-fi near future,
which
we've seen now, you know, how much in other mediums too, in television or movies.
Did they use the term biotech in comics in
1983? I don't know.
Probably not very much.
Yeah, I mean, that whole aspect of that story with the, you know, cybernetic implants and that kind of thing. I remember reading it, just, you know, it was so creative and imaginative and
cyborgs
really beyond,
with samurai swords and demons, and
which today is, you know, you'd see it all the time, but at the time it didn't exist. It hadn't really seen anything, at least, you know, in mainstream comics, you hadn't really seen anything like that. So.
And now I think because of a lot of the success of Frank Miller inspired movies, we're going to see Ronin.
I remember when the Robert De Niro Ronin first came out. I was like, oh my God, they're making that. You know, I couldn't believe that they were going to make that into a movie, and then they didn't. And Ronin, the film,
a good movie.
It was a good movie.
Yeah, because it's not Ronin.
Yeah, and they're like, wow.
Well, in January of 1986, Miller returned to the series that had made him one of comics' hottest talents. This time, teaming up with artist David Mazzucchelli, Daredevil Born Again introduced readers to Matt Murdock's Catholic background and furthered the complicated relationships between he and both Karen Page and the Kingpin. And here is Frank Miller fan and co-host of the Bullpen Bulletins podcast, David Price, on Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli.
My favorite Miller stories are probably ones he's written with one particular creator, and that would be David Mazzucchelli. My favorite Marvel story Frank Miller has done is Daredevil Born Again, and my favorite DC story Miller has done so far is Batman Year One. These two stories, it's almost like Frank and David were just working off each other. David knew exactly what to draw based on what Frank was writing, and Frank seemed to be writing for David. It was just amazing work. I can't picture any other creator telling this story, be it a writer or an artist. Fantastic work all around. And if it were true that the end of Born Again was to be the last Daredevil story, I can't picture a more fitting end seeing Matt and Karen walking on the page. Then it really does have a sense of closure. I'm glad Frank got to write that story, and I'm glad David got to draw it. The only other thing I can really add is that even though he's you know, known as a writer or an artist or a director or screenwriter or anything like that, he's got many talents, and when I just look back at Frank Miller, whether it's working with Dave Gibbons or Jeff Darrow or John Romita Jr. or Todd McFarlane, he's a creator. That's pretty much it. That's what I can sum the man up as.
One of the interesting themes we can also kind of talk about with Frank Miller is the fact that he's been able to go and put out a series like Daredevil and define a character, and then later come back and sort of do it all over again, which is what he did with Born Again. You know, Born Again, and the amazing thing about Born Again is, you know, it was right in the series. It was, you know, the six issues right in the middle of the series, and And I remember reading those, and they just blew me away. It was it was this tortured Matt Murdock, everything taken away from him. You had this calculated kingpin who just wanted to systematically destroy Matt Murdock.
An ultimate betrayal.
Yeah, that was. I mean, that was the other part of it. It was all you know, started by Karen Page, you know, and then ultimately, you know, it goes, you know, his redemption, and you know, after losing everything that he could possibly lose, the only thing he had left was his own sort of soul and the man that he is, as opposed to the character that he is, or the superhero that he is, or the lawyer that he is, or the blind kid that he is. You know, it really had nothing to do with that. It all had to do with who he was inside, from mostly from his, you know, his father, and it was just this unbelievable examination of that character. And to do it twice,
yeah,
you know, to the same character, is just on, you know, it's most creators probably never do it once, and he was able to do it in a short amount of time. Now he's done it with two, you know, Daredevil twice, Wolverine once, you know, and he's not even close to being done.
And that's kind of what Born Again was. It was taking everything that he had done in that phenomenal first run of Daredevil and saying, you know what, yeah, that was great, but now it's time to flip this character again and redefine it for another generation. And for a lot of people, Born Again was the first Daredevil that they read. Mm-hmm. We've seen that repeatedly on the forum this week.
Yeah, and Mazzucchelli's stuff, you know, unbelievable. I mean, there's actually, if you read the trade, there's an introduction by Ralph Macchio, who basically says that if there were two guys that were born to work together, it was Mazzucchelli and Frank Miller, because their styles just complemented one another so well. And you know, it's hard to argue that. I mean, they do seem to just, for whatever reason. I mean, there's been other, you know, Frank's own art with his writing, mm-hmm. is one thing, and you know, other people's art with his writing is another. But for whatever reason, Mazzucchelli and him just seem, you know, it's like epic. You know what I mean? It's bigger than just it's bigger than just a comic, for sure. Whatever reason, when they've collaborated.
And you see that in Miller's career with different artists, and we'll touch on that with Elektra and Sienkiewicz, and you'll see it, you know, again with you know, his partnership with Klaus Janson. And basically any artist that he's worked with, he seems to capture a voice with them. You know, Jeff Darrow with Hardboiled has never, you know, probably never been as good as he was on that series with the two of them working together. And we'll talk about all of those works in just a little bit. But here's the big one, I think, for a lot of folks. And 1986 is regarded by many as a landmark year in the history of comics. DC was in the midst of crisis, and Alan Moore's Watchmen was deconstructing the superhero genre. Just when readers thought that they knew what to expect from Frank Miller, everything changed. In March of 1986, The Dark Knight Returns threw readers into a not-so-distant future where a retired Batman is forced to resume his role as Gotham's Dark Knight. DKR not only removed the campy image of the 1960s television Batman, it served as a template for a new generation of darker and more brooding stories of DC's Dark Detective.
Dark Knight Returns is my all-time favorite comic ever. I've read it more than anything else. I've probably read it 20 times or more.
Probably bought it in at least 5 different versions.
Yeah, something like that. But I absolutely love that book, and I don't even know if I can tell you why so much. The artwork, for one, is maybe some of Frank's best, because of Klaus Janson, and even their best together, I think. While it had this whole new look for these characters that you've seen before, it was still part of what you knew, just magnified. It was like you knew this was Batman, but it was not the Batman that you grew up knowing, even if you read comics for years. And it was like comics on steroids or something. It was, you know, this unbelievable electric combination of energy and weirdness, and it came out and it changed everything. And that's not a exaggeration. It's still, the effects of Dark Knight Returns is still being felt in the comic industry, probably more for bad now than good, but for whatever, I mean, that's not Frank's fault. It changed anything what people thought about a character that we thought we knew everything about, and redefined it. Once again, taking a character and redefining it completely, changing what you think of it, and changing what you thought about Frank Miller's work, even though he had already done this hugely successful work on Daredevil, the Wolverine stuff, the Daredevil Born Again,
Ronin.
All of a sudden, this was something that was completely different, that was not, you know, what Frank had done before. And that's, you know, to me, the mark of greatness is, you know, when you are able to redo, you know, reimagine yourself and recreate things and keep busting through and keep changing and not be afraid to change. And Dark Knight did all those things. It completely obliterated anything anyone thought about about Batman, and really set the modern Batman. I mean, that, you know, is still what we look at Batman.
It's a before and after. There was Batman before, and there's Batman after. We talked about the working relationship with Miller and Mazzucchelli on Born Again. There's a name that was almost synonymous with Frank Miller from an art side, and that was Klaus Janson. We had a chance to talk with inker, artist, writer Andy Parks on Frank Miller and Klaus Janson as an art team.
Well, Klaus, I think, is perfect for him. I don't want to compare Phil and I to those guys, because we're not on their level, but we do think about making lines in the same way, so we kind of get along in an artistic way. We're a good partnership, and I think Frank and Klaus were that way. I think they just saw things the same way. They believed in the same kind of graphic idea, you know, kind of graphics that really punch you in the face, even all the way up to Dark Knight, which I think created some tension, because I think Frank wanted it to look not quite as conventional as what Klaus gave him, so I think there was some tension there. To me, Klaus's work on that really pulls it together and kind of holds it down into the DC universe in a way that makes it more powerful.
And Andy, of course, was talking about Phil Hester there as his
Frank Miller.
His Frank, yes. I'm sure that Phil would love to be referred to as Andy's Frank Miller.
Well, I don't think there'd be anybody better to talk about a relationship between a penciler and an inker than Andy. I mean, him and Phil have worked so well together for so many years.
Oh, they're
I mean, they're one and the same almost. But as far as Klaus, I was amazed to find out years later, after having loved so much of their work together, of how much of that sort of classic Frank Miller style that I loved was Klaus Janson.
Oh, yeah.
There's some stuff, if you look in the Absolute Dark Knight, there's a lot of backup material in it. And there's some stuff in there that is really amazing. In, you see the penciled work of Frank's, and then you see the inked work. And sometimes it's night and day. I mean, not as far as quality, but in the style. It's like, and I think a lot of times when people think of Frank Miller, myself included for a long time, mm-hmm. they're actually thinking more about Klaus Janson. But Klaus has done a lot of work himself,
sure,
in comics, outside of just
inking. And I like his style.
I do too. Yeah. And it has that same look, but you can still see it's not, they are that perfect relationship. You know what I mean? It's like one is weaker without the other. You know, it's like Frank's pencils just aren't the same without his inks, and Klaus's pencils or inks without going on top of Frank's pencils, just they don't create the same magic.
Well, I forget how many issues of Daredevil, but quite a bit there at the end of Frank's first big run on it. Frank was really just doing breakdowns
and layouts, and Klaus was doing,
yeah, and Janson was doing the majority of the art on it.
It is amazing how similar their stuff is. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had to have had a lot of similar influences, yep. And I mean, just in their line work and a lot of the things that they do, it's very similar, but at the same time it's different, and for whatever reason it just works together so well.
Then in February of 1987, Miller would combine the successful ingredients of two of his previous year's triumphs, returning to Batman, this time to the beginning of his days as the Dark Knight. Miller called on David Mazzucchelli to pencil Batman Year One.
Come here, David Mazzucchelli, and pencil this book for me.
Come here. Contained in Batman issues 404 through 407, Year One became the definitive early history of Batman and was much of the inspiration of 2006's Batman Begins feature film. And coming off of Dark Knight Returns, he redefines the character again within a year, but this time at the beginning instead of the end of the character's career as a crime fighter.
Yeah, he goes, and like I said before, you know, it's like he comes back again and goes, you know, let's just play with this again and create something iconic. Batman's an interesting character. It's like the one few one he keeps coming back to, though. He hasn't really done any Daredevil, you know, since Born Again, and well, he did do the John Romita Jr. Man with No Fear. But Batman, it's like that character he just keeps coming back to.
I think Frank loves Batman's single-minded obsession. I think there are similarities in Frank as a person that he.
I'm not going to go there. That seems like a. No, I'm just kidding.
But do you know what I mean? I think that you would almost have to see a lot of yourself in a character to keep coming back to him. And certainly Daredevil and Batman are the two characters that he has, you know, revisited over and over again in his career, that he just seems to understand those two characters maybe more than anyone else.
I was trying to find in this Miller-Eisner interview, there was an interesting sort of statement he had. I can't find the exact thing, but I'll paraphrase. They were talking about Batman, and Frank was saying, yeah, you know, there's people that that care way more about Batman, the character, than any version of Batman that I've ever done. You know, and they care more about Batman than they do Frank Miller's Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And those people absolutely hate Frank Miller now because of what he's done with Batman. And it's like they look at it like this holy religious artifact that you can't ever break, you can't ever toy with. And I think Frank looks at it way more like a toy that he can have fun with. And that's why he can keep coming back to Batman, because it's this toy that he can, you know, now he has the, you know, the sort of clout to do whatever he wants. You know, it's like, hey, I want to draw Batman.
If Frank Miller wants to work on Batman, then damn it, Frank Miller's going to work
absolutely
on Batman.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, it's just he doesn't take it maybe nearly as seriously as we do sometimes. And he likes to have fun with the character, I think, and really see, you know, how crazy and insane. Because and we'll talk about it maybe more when we get into Dark Knight 2. Mm-hmm. Which is something I want to talk about. But, you know, Batman's an interesting character in the DCU because of that, because of his unique uniqueness. And there's not really a lot of other characters that are much like him compared to the other superheroes that are in the DC universe. And I think that's what sort of attracts him maybe to that character a bit.
Oh, absolutely. And you see that repeatedly through his Batman work. Batman Year One, I think, is a quintessential work, not just of Miller's, but of the Batman catalog. It is one of the, if you want to introduce someone to the character of Batman, what he is at his core, you know, how he became Batman, mm-hmm. and everything that is great about that character, you give them Batman Year One.
Yeah, it is the official origin story of Batman now. It is canon.
You want to know who Batman is? Here, yeah. Start here, and then we'll figure things out as we go.
And a lot of people are bigger fans of that book, Batman, than Dark Knight.
Sure.
I know a lot of people think that it's a better work, and I personally think it's awesome and it's an amazing piece.
It fits in continuity.
Yeah, well,
Yeah.
It's kind of been, I don't want to say,
I mean, he changed some stuff, but
yeah, I don't know. I don't want to say it's been shoehorned in, but you know, you said it's,
well,
the,
he's
it's
retconned. Yeah. I mean, he but he did it in a way that, you know, it's like most of the time when you hear retcon, it's like, oh, but you know, when he did it, it was like, oh, you know, I mean, it was like, yeah, it was good as opposed to
he's one of the few, wow, that's better than I imagined,
right?
Yeah,
well, that's, you know.
There are some other folks out there that have some remembrances of Frank Miller and him coming up through the ranks and redefining these characters. And this is one that you may not have expected.
First of all, apologies for the fidelity of this recording. It's Gypsy Pride Day in Latveria, so the streets are filled with violins and scarves and much yelling. I'm forced to record this in Doom's storage room. When I think of Frank Miller, I think of the first time I met him, which was at a Ninjan and hot air balloon enthusiast fair in the early 80s. I was there with my newly constructed dirigible, the Grim and Gritty. He was peddling scythes and katanas out of a motorcycle sidecar. He struck me as a kindred spirit, so I invited him to share in a feast of fresh boar and Latverian spring water. I told him of my idea for a book about an aging but handsome and genius dude. Is forced back into action by a new threat to Dune's beloved Latveria. Frank Miller stole it and made Dark Knight Returns. I'm still waiting for acknowledgement, Frank. Dune wants his props. I also coined the phrase, I am the goddamn Dr. Doom, in an answering machine message in the mid-80s. Rock over London, rock over Chicago. Doom out.
I often wondered what Dr. Doom may think of Frank Miller. Has Frank ever done Dr. Doom? Has he ever drawn or written Dr. Doom? I'm trying to think.
I think he showed
maybe
up.
Maybe in a team-up or something. I have my probably complete Frank Miller Spider-Man here. Let's see.
Probably a cover or two,
yeah,
I would guess.
I'm just trying to think if he ever did any Doom stories. I mean, he never worked on the Fantastic Four.
Oh, even when he's not here, he's here, isn't he?
Yes, yes. Oh, here we go. Yep, he did in Marvel Team Up. Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 15. Looks like he did. And it's got Doom and someone that looks like the Toad. I don't know why the Toad would be in there. But, and Frank did the pencils on it. So there you go.
Dormammu.
Dormammu. Is in it. Doctor Strange is in it. Some big robot guy is in it. I don't know. All sorts of craziness in there. So go back and... I was going to mention this book, by the way. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many people have ever picked this up, but it's Complete Frank Miller Spider-Man, and it's a lot of his really early stuff before he did Daredevil.
Yeah.
Marvel team-up stuff, and it's way more superhero-y stuff than say, Daredevil or whatever. But if you want to see like his, you know, sort of real early work at Marvel, there's some good stuff in here. So,
but you want to see him drawing Doom.
Doom.
Who deserves his props. And apparently Punisher. And apparently wants royalties.
Well, rock out, London. Rock out. Doom.
Doom's whack.
Doom's crazy, man.
All right, moving forward, but actually moving back a little bit, around the time that The Dark Knight Returns was coming out in 1986. Miller was working on another project with another artist that would help redefine comics, and that was Bill Sienkiewicz. Two of them produced an 8-issue limited series under the Epic imprint. Boy, if you remember Epic.
Oh, yes.
Called Elektra Assassin. Not just a fan favorite from the pages of his run on Daredevil anymore, Elektra was a strong enough character to carry her own series. In the mid-80s, she was the perfect character to showcase in the creative team's wild, out-of-continuity tale of cyborgs and ninjas. It was a when in doubt, use cyborgs and ninjas time in comics, I guess.
Maybe. I don't know. All I know is this book blew me away when it came out. Sienkiewicz's art is just unbelievable. I mean, obviously people know him now, but at the time I had no idea. I didn't really had ever seen his stuff before. And when I saw that, man, it was like nothing I had ever seen. It was so weird and out there and extreme. And you want to talk about experimental. I mean, that guy does more experimentation in an issue than most people do in careers.
I was 13 when this came out, and when I bought it, I thought I was reading something that I shouldn't.
Yeah, it definitely has that feel to it. It almost has a porn feel to it because it's
neon, big lights.
Yeah, absolutely. It's Sienkiewicz's art. It's just it has that very
there's something narcotic about it.
Feel about yeah. it, and but that's a great story and. Talk about a guy that just is amazing. I mean, the story by Frank is great, but the artwork is awesome by Sienkiewicz.
And it's not something that you... I mean, you can flip through for an appreciation of the art just to get the feel of it, but it is a dense read.
There's a lot going on.
And
it is like, you know, I mean, this is a out of continuity, out of... It's like a Elseworlds Electra story, because it makes no friggin' sense. I mean, there's crap going on in here.
Well, that's when Epic... At Marvel was really the line for them to do their experimental, just wacky, out there stuff. Epic.
If
there
only
was
it
so
still existed.
Oh, there was so much cool stuff coming
out
of Epic.
We could do
time.
A whole show on Epic.
It was. We should do a whole show on
Epic. Well, maybe we will.
All right. Moving on. May of 1987, Miller drew the covers for the first 12 issues of First Comics, Lone Wolf and Cub. This helped bring Japanese manga to a wider Western audience. And that's, you know, once again, 1987 for me, I was probably 14.
Probably.
14, yeah, right around in there. And I had
junior in high school.
Well, no knowledge.
Smoking weed.
Gosh.
Get laid.
Reading Electric Assassin.
That's
whoa.
Right.
I had no knowledge of manga, but I did have knowledge of Frank Miller. And so I saw these Frank Miller covers of Lone Wolf and Cub.
Mm-hmm.
And while I'm not a huge manga fan or reader now, I still love Lone Wolf and Cub.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it really did sort of help usher in manga, you know, at that time. And I think I'm trying to remember back, maybe Akira was maybe one of the first things I had mm-hmm. ever seen, but Lone Wolf and Cub was right there with it as far as the whole Japanese comics, and Frank was once again way ahead of the curve on that, you know. And Lone Wolf and Cub is an amazing series in its own right
stories.
And if you're a fan of like Kurosawa films, you know, those were very influential on the Lone Wolf and Cub stories. And
I'm just thinking back to the mid and late 80s, and the whole country's fascination with ninjas and swords and throwing stars, and it's
Frank
Miller was right at the middle of that as a comic fan, and you know it's. Growing up in Bumblebee, Southern Illinois, you know,
you had the influx,
you had to have a throwing star.
You had influx of you know, ninja films, and you know, following on the footsteps of you know, like Bruce Lee, who really I think was the first, you know, introduction of you know, kung fu movies and that kind of stuff. He was really, you know, the big star at that time. But then after he died and everything, and you saw Jackie Chan and more stuff, and then you had like, you know, I remember Kung Fu Theater and.
You know, at just that time, you know, martial arts and ninjas.
It exploded. It was huge in every aspect of pop culture.
Sure. Well, that's why, you know, later Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles would become so popular, and that is, you know, so derivative of all of Miller's work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I mean, it's not even...
They don't even hide it.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's not like influenced by. It's, you know, it's straight up.
It
swipe.
Should say, you
I
know,
mean,
thank you, Frank. At the
yeah,
end
and
of
I
each
think
issue.
You know, those guys.
Oh, they.
Yeah, and I don't think they ever thought it was going to be what it turned into when they started it. I mean, it was just like this indie little cool indie comic that they did, and it exploded along with the rest of the country. You know, if anything, was a perfect storm.
Exactly.
That was a perfect storm, but I mean, it's just another area where Frank was ahead of the curve and influential in so many different places.
Yeah, and if you haven't seen the covers that he did for,
I keep calling him Frank like I know him.
I know.
I kind of feel like I do.
Yeah, he's been with me my entire, you know, comic reading life.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's you know, Frank is always
yeah.
Been there.
Well, yeah, you think about it that way. I mean, since I started reading comics, he was. Like one of the first creators that I've ever followed mm-hmm. and continue to, and yeah. Always has.
It's around the time that that this is all happening, Miller, along with Marv Wolfman, Alan Moore, Howard Chaykin, and others, had been in a dispute with DC Comics over a proposed rating system for comics. Disagreeing with what he saw as censorship, Miller refused to do any further work at DC and would take all of his further works to Dark Horse. From now on, Miller would be a major supporter of creator rights, and we have some interesting comments from fellow creator John Byrne on editorial control and moving on to creator-owned works.
Yeah, that was probably the first place that Frank and I had a kind of a disagreement in basic philosophical stuff, because he did talk about, you know, DC trying to tie down stronger editorial controls at one point. He did get up in arms about that, calling it censorship, and my point was, well, they own the characters. If they want to tell us what to do with it, that's pretty much their right. That's not censorship. That's what editorial control is all about. And if you want to not have to worry about that, go create your own characters, which I ultimately did with Next Men and some other stuff, and which he, of course, did with Sin City. So we both found our ways back to the same place again, you know, with the creator-owned stuff. We got there by different roads. Yeah, well, the driving force for me, I can't actually speak, you know, for Frank's particular motivations, but I'm sure they were very similar to this. I realized eventually that there were just too many stories that I couldn't do working for Marvel or DC. And it wasn't about censorship, it was about what's already been done. In for example, to take something fairly cliche, in the Marvel Universe, you can't do the first alien contact story. You can't do the first time travel story. You can't do stories set in the future, because all of those things are tied down. We know what the first alien contact was. We know what the first time travel story was. We know what the future looks like. So I came to a point of realizing that if I wanted to do the kinds of stories I was itching to do, if I wanted to kind of explore those first-time things and those areas that had been so heavily explored already in these shared universes, I was going to have to go to something that wasn't a shared universe. And I'm sure that Frank had very much the same idea. There was no way that Sin City could have been a city in the DC universe or a city in the Marvel universe. They just weren't structured that way. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Frank never even thought of putting Sin City in either of those universes. He wouldn't want, you know, Captain America turning up in Sin City. But that was kind of where we were both coming from, as I say, coming down different paths to get to the same point, where you just say, if I'm going to do the kind of stuff that I'm really itching to do right now, I have to do it with total control. I can't do it filtered through an editor or filtered through a publisher who's going to be worried about protecting his own interests. It has to be, you know, me out there on the firing line. You know, that's probably literally how Frank would have thought about it. He'd want to put himself on the firing line.
All right, so there you go. Some insight into the climate of comics at the time, with not just creator rights, but editorial control and creative license to do what these guys wanted to do. I think what was starting to happen is that Frank Miller and other creators were getting to a point that that the art form was ready to expand, and the iconic characters that they had been able to use weren't going to expand with them.
Well, and I also think it was a matter, I mean, for someone like Frank, where, you know, he had done this work that created so much more popularity for these characters, and yet wasn't necessarily seeing anything out of it. You know, as opposed mm-hmm. to, You know what I mean? It's like, okay, he does Dark Knight Return, and I don't know what his deal was with that or what, you know, how much whatever he got paid or whatever. That, you know, I'm just sort of assuming that, you know, at that time, creator rights were limited, and for him to sort of look at it like, well, you know, there's going to be creators, you know, after me that are going to do stuff like this too, and if they don't, you know, if we don't do something about this now, they're not going to get anything out of it. You know, they're not. And it also led to, you know, you talk about the censorship and editorial control, and it led to Frank's, you know, campaign for really the rest of his career now. Someone who's, you know, fought against censorship for the rest of his career. I mean, that's, you know, he's really been in the forefront of that for a long time now.
He's the kind of guy that, I imagine, doesn't want to be boxed in. You know, that's the last thing that you ever want to do to a person and a talent like Frank Miller is try and put him in a box, because the first thing he's going to do is try and get out of that box.
Can't put a rainbow in a jar, my friend. That's timeless. Well, the interesting, I mean, there was about a 4 or 5 year period now between his last work for Marvel or DC, which was you know, the Elektra Assassin, mm-hmm. and the other, and. In that time period, I think he was making his first foray into Hollywood. He had worked on RoboCop, the script, and some other stuff that didn't, you know, end up being as fantastic as his comics work. And he hadn't really done anything in a while in the comics industry. And reading in some interviews and stuff, he's talked about when he came back. And he decided he was going to, you know, he wanted to do something in comics again. That's, you know, it's but he was going to do exactly what he wanted to do. And he sat down and did Sin City. Mm-hmm. And it was, there was no editorial constraint. It was exactly how he wanted it to be. He, you know, from start to finish and did everything in it. And there was nobody telling him what he could or couldn't do. And, you know, there were no guarantees. I mean, nobody knew, you know, he didn't know what it was going to be like. He just had belief in his own talent and ability, and he had these stories he wanted to tell, and lo and behold, here's the next step for Frank Miller. He creates this, you know, whole revitalization of noir in comics, and once again, we see, you know, his influence today still with guys, you know, doing noir like Brubaker and line of guys, so...
And here we have Andy Parks talking about Sin City and how Sin City is a true noir comic.
When Sin City came out, I was already a huge fan of his, but that project really blew me away and was really inspiring to me, because he had the position in the industry and he had the balls to say, screw it, I don't need to make a fat paycheck right now doing another Batman, another Daredevil. I'm going to go do something all on my own terms. I'm going to do it just the way I want to. And I'm just going to lay it out there and have faith that people are going to find it. And fortunately, when he does it, it's so brilliant that it. I think it not it doesn't just draw in people who are already into that kind of material. It's strong enough that it can draw people in who've never been into noir, never knew they were into noir before. His work is just that powerful, I think. If you're talking about a noir film, of course it has that look. It's black and white. It's very stark. It's the lighting in it is very direct, bold images and so on. Rainy streets, cool cars, all those noir hallmarks that you think of visually. As far as themes and story goes, it's got classic noir protagonist in every story, some guy who's completely flawed and operates outside of normal life, or what we would consider normal, outside of the system, and yet somebody that you're drawn to and kind of root for despite the fact that they have all these flaws and maybe a violent, despicable person, you still find yourself kind of pulling for the guy. In the first one, I love the character of Marv, who's just too... a guy who knows he's not very bright and knows his limitations really well and still kind of, you know, strives as best he can, even though he knows what his limitations are. I think that's really cool. He also... Frank is not obligated as... guys like Jim Thompson were not to give you a tidy, happy ending. He's not afraid to just end this with a, you know, some kind of apocalyptic end to our character that we've come to know and love. And that's another noir hallmark. You can't find much cooler than those guys electrocuting Marv and him looking up and saying, "I'm looking at it right now." He says, "Is that the best you can do, you pansies?"
Sin City is, I think if you take Frank Miller and boil down his creative vision, it turns into Sin City. I mean, that is probably the purest Frank Miller work that we've seen.
Yeah, it's all him. There's nothing. There's no, you know, there's no constraints. There's no limitations. There's no. It's exactly everything that he wanted to do. And
I think it's the perfect mix of his love of film and his love of comics.
And he's talked about how how film does certain things great, but there's things you can do in comics that you can't do in film. Specifically, you know, moments in time and holding and pauses and different things like that, and culminations of different characters talking at the same time and different, you know. So you see a lot of that in Sin City. And also at this time, I mean, it's like this is sort of we see another, artistically, more experimentation from him. We see a different art style in Sin City, especially as those series went on. Mm-hmm. More and more of sort of the exaggeration and cartoonish stuff, even though these stories are incredibly dark and serious. There's also humor in them, to twisted humor, but humor nonetheless. But his style, his art style, where he's completely I don't want to say unhinged, but untethered by anything. You see it evolve into something that's much more, a lot closer to what we see today. Once again, and you can look at Ronin, which was sort of the precursor to this. You could see a lot of the stuff in Ronin you can see in Sin City.
Sure.
But
sure.
It's polished more, and there's more,
artistically, his use of negative space and positive space, the white silhouette, which
is a
trademark of Sin City. Mm-hmm. Now it's the single
splash spot color stuff and much more brave in just experimenting with stuff. I mean, the rain scenes and using white ink on top of black stuff. And I read in this book, I can't recommend this book enough for anyone that's either an Eisner or a Miller fan. But with Sin City, interesting thing, he was inking it all, and he would do it in almost like an assembly line process. He would go through, pencil the entire book, go back, lay in all the flat blacks, then go back and ink in all the detail, start to finish. Most people, even if they're inking their own stuff, it's like, I'll pencil this page and then I'll ink, maybe I'll pencil five pages and then go back and ink those five pages, then I'll move on to the next five. He would pencil the entire book and go back. And why he was doing it was sort of like he wanted to keep fresh on all of it, so like he could keep the whole story in mind when he was working at it. He could pencil the whole thing in one voice, then go back and ink it all in one voice, and keep fresh on each page, on each section of it, instead of like getting tired of drawing this section and moving on to another one and that kind of thing. But I thought that was really interesting that he did it in that way. And you can kind of, when you think about it, when you're reading the books, you can kind of see that process take hold of the story, and it is such a clear, distinctive voice throughout the whole thing. I mean, it's very, very much the same.
One of the things I loved about Sin City was its use of non-linear storylines. Characters that have been killed or, gone away for whatever reason can come back through his weird timeline that you never, that's the thing about Sin City, is that it's always kind of just left of center from reality.
It's a fantasy world. I mean, it's not reality. It's not supposed to be. It's hyper Los Angeles.
Yes.
It's hyper noir. It's not true, true noir. You know what I mean?
It's derivative of.
Yeah, but it's taken, blown up and twisted and.
Well, and Andy said it takes all of the core elements of noir.
Right.
And it does use them, but then it expands.
It's Frank Millard.
Yeah, and then it gets Millard.
Yeah. But Sin City is, is another, and, you know, obviously with the film and everything coming out, and it's another one of his just leaps. It's like every time he comes out with something, it's this. It's not small. You know what I mean? I mean, he's done small books, but it's like he's had so many of these just gigantic leaps in his career of stuff that's just unbelievable. And I know that there are some people that think that, you know, with Sin City, that's when his art started to decline.
Oh, God, no.
And I hate hearing, well, with the later stories, with like a Yellow Bastard and Family Values and stuff like that. But
it's not like he forgot how to draw.
Yeah, and that's the thing that drives me nuts when I hear that. It's like, oh, he's lost it. He's, you know, whatever. I'm like, there's some people that say, oh, he's not evolving, he's not changing. That's, you know, but I completely disagree
that's
with that.
All he's ever done in his career.
Yeah,
is
he's
and
done
change.
It again and again and again. And I personally think I can see what, you know, the changes and why he's doing it and what. And if you listen to his interviews and you hear the man speak about, you know, what he's doing, it makes complete sense to me. But that's me.
Know. I don't want to sound like a total Frank Miller apologist. That's not why we're doing this episode. That's not why. I mean, we love his work. We're huge fans. But, you know, are there things that he's done in his career that I like more than other things? Absolutely.
Sure.
I think for both of us, like Dark Knight is probably the pinnacle for us as far as everything working to our taste. But you look at things that he's done in Sin City, you look at things that he's done in, you know, DK2 or whatever point in his career he was trying to do something different. And sometimes it works to a masterful effect. Sometimes it is just a sidestep in his artistic process, but I'm never going to fault anyone for trying to break out.
And I'm always
going to
give a guy like that the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, you think if anyone's earned it, it's Frank Miller.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see a decline in his art at all. I certainly see a change in his art. I mean, there's no questioning that. But I don't see it as a decline. I know a lot of people do, but a decline to me would, you know, be, I mean, it's so sort of subjective because it depends on what you consider quality artwork or whatever. But to me, it's like if you look at DK2, and that's probably the quintessential piece that people go, oh, well, that's, you know, he's completely lost
that
in his artwork.
That is the polarizing piece.
And it's like if he was, you know, and I've heard people say, oh, well, he just mailed that in. Or he just, you know, he's lost, you know, whatever. He's gone crazy. He just... But if you look at that book and you look at how much time and thought is put into the sequential stuff that is done in that book, the, you know, I'm not talking about the line work, like the characterization or how this character body is developed or
rendered.
I'm talking about the sequential art, the how he's telling the story with the pages and with the panels. There's so much thought put into it, more thought put into that book, which I know people hate, than most comics that come out today. So it's like I find it hard to believe that he just mailed that in, or his, you know, his skills are declining, when it's obvious that, you know, this guy is, if you look at those pages and you study sequential art, and you, I mean, there's some masterful stuff in there.
I think there's still a lot of soul to the work.
Oh yeah. And whether you love the story or hate the story, that's not what I'm talking about. If you're going to judge it on an artistic merit, just on, you know, on that, look at that part of it too, not whether or not you liked it because it was a different style.
I think, and once again, not to be an apologist, I've liked DK2. I think that book...
It was a victim of the success of DK, of Dark Knight Returns.
Absolutely, and I think it's one of those that, you know, it became fashionable to
bash
jump,
it
to jump on it.
We love nothing more in this country than to build someone up and then tear them down.
Well, sure.
And like I said, I'm not trying to say that that's a great work or a quintessential piece of
it's
Frank
not his
Miller.
Best. I don't
no,
think
it's not
best
his best work. It's not, certainly not. Not even close.
But I think the piling on.
Yeah, I think the people that just like absolutely rail on it, I don't see it. I honestly just don't see...
It's different. It's different than anything else that he's done.
And maybe it was just the time it was done. You know, it's like people weren't ready to accept anything that different.
Well, I think there was a lot going on with the world, with the after effects of 9/11. Now, how much of that influenced the book, I don't know, because, you know, you have to kind of look at the weird time, how much of it was done before 9/11, how much of it was done after. It just, I know that it was coming out around that time.
I don't know. I don't honestly know, you know, how much of it he had done beforehand. I mean, if you look at the third issue of that book, I mean, it seems that obviously, as a New Yorker, he was affected by 9/11, I'd imagine, and it worked its way into that. And it may have been some of the problems with the story is that I think maybe he tried to change things there, and that, you know, that third issue, maybe not everything made complete sense because he was trying to force some stuff in there that wasn't initially intended. But after 9/11, it was, you know, maybe he felt...
How could it not?
Yeah, exactly. How does it not change somebody? I mean, you know.
And actually had a chance to talk with writer Jerry Duggan. He, apart from being a comic book writer, interviewed Frank Miller and wrote the Icons biography on G4. So Jerry had spent some time with Frank, and here he is talking about 9/11 and maybe some of the effects on Miller as a creator.
Well, and his reaction to 9/11 was, you know, he was an artist living in New York when that happened. So he watched those planes fly into the buildings and the buildings fall as a New Yorker.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if we'll ever see, you know, Holy Terror Batman, but that was obviously another extension of that. It was an anger that he felt that he channeled that, you know, I hope we see it someday. I don't know if we will.
Yeah, I mean, how does it, you know, I mean, I'm not from New York, but I can only imagine what people there, you know, just as an American, it affected me, let alone if I lived in New York and, you know, spent as much time as he did in there, and as an artist who's often worked in the realm of politics and war and different aspects of that, and you know, yeah, you would expect it. Like I said, I don't know how much effect it had, yeah, or how much it didn't, or what it changed in the story, or what it didn't. So,
well, I want to move on to one of the last major works of Frank Miller
so far.
So yes, and it's definitely a continuing story. In May of 1998, Miller would create another series destined for the big screen, presented in double-page spreads with a built-in widescreen feel. 300 was Miller's vision of 300 Spartan soldiers who defied government authority to hold back the entire Persian army. Story of honor, valor, and determination in the face of insurmountable odds, 300 further cemented Miller as a master of the comic medium and continued a series of now highly successful movie adaptions. Mm-hmm. 300 is one of my favorite movies. Not just comic book movies.
Favorite movies all time?
Movies.
Wow.
I love the epic vision of it. I love the effects. I love the characters, the feel. The comic book aside, it is an amazing vision on screen. I loved 300.
Yeah, it was awesome. I think it was probably the only comic book movie that I've ever watched that was, I don't want to say better,
maybe more fully realized on the big screen than,
yeah,
the comic.
I mean, because it was like there were things that happened in the film that finally, like, all of a sudden I went back to the book and went, oh, that makes so much more sense now to me, seeing it on screen and seeing it in four dimensions as opposed to, you know, flat on a page.
Adding another small storyline to it pulled the rest of the
rest of the stuff together a little bit. I thought that was, yeah, yeah, it was the one time where, like, stuff was changed in a
positive way.
Yeah. and I don't think it's, and I don't mean that in a way to, like, you know, disparage 300, the graphic novel.
No,
or
it's a great series.
And I just think it's because it was like such a great story. It was like too much for the medium almost. I mean, it needed to be made into a film. But once again, it's just him pushing the boundaries and, you know, not accepting what's come before as the only thing that can happen.
Mm-hmm. Definitely need to mention Lynn Varley's colors in the series.
Absolutely.
It's the coloring, it added a dimension that, you know, it's a different book with any other
Yeah,
colors.
There's no question. And he's talked about in this. He's talked about how with coloring and him. I mean, he pretty much is hands off when it comes to coloring of his work, especially with Lynn Varney. That he just is like it's a whole nother creative process that he lets happen outside of.
He kind of knows his limitations there, I guess.
Well, maybe, yeah. I mean, I think. I think he likes black and white. I think he likes working in black and white. And when it comes to color, I think he just thinks that other people are better suited to do it than he is. And with Lynn Varney, you know, most of the time that's truly the case.
Well, I think next up for Frank Miller in the immediate future is his plan to direct The Spirit, which you've been talking about this Will Eisner, Frank Miller book.
Yes.
And what's the name of the book again?
It's just called Eisner Miller. It's actually from Dark Horse. They published it. Basically one long conversation over a weekend between Frank Miller and Will Eisner, who were very good friends. And this was the last, as far as I know, the last published interview of Will Eisner before he passed away. And I think... They were very different people, but very similar. Obviously, age, you know, they were very different in age, but kindred spirits, and they love to argue about stuff. And this is sort of them talking about all sorts of aspects of the comic book industry, you know, from 1942 up until today. And I got a lot of insight, a lot of sort of, knowledge, I think, about these two guys that I didn't know before, because it was strictly a, you know, like a conversation. It was like sort of eavesdropping on these two old friends talking, and I got a lot of perspective about these two creators that I hadn't had before. So I really recommend it. I think if you're a fan of these guys, if you're into, you know, interviews and that kind of thing about creators, I think it's an excellent work, and I've really enjoyed it.
Well, Eisner certainly has a legacy. That goes without saying. And I think that Frank Miller is definitely going to have a legacy. And here is Jerry Duggan talking about just that.
Well, I think Frank's legacy is going to be really unique. I mean, he obviously has one side of that coin is all the comic book work and sort of the several times that he turned the medium on its head. Then the other side will be the side that's really still being written, and that's the Hollywood film work. And, you know, with Sin City and then later with what Zack Snyder and Larry Fong and everyone did to bring 300 to life, because that really, as much as, you know, in a lot of ways I thought the film is just a great adaptation, that and V for Vendetta, and I think Frank's legacy, his success, I would say, at the box office really makes it easier for films to be made that are truer to the comic book. It's a security blanket for the people that are making the movies, that are signing the checks, really, to say, I feel better about signing away X amount of dollars because it was a successful comic book and everyone wants to have the next sort of Frank Miller success. You know, Sin City was not just an enjoyable film, but it was profitable. 300 is very much the same. And so, you know, Frank, really, I didn't know what the Icons program was going to be about, really, until I sat down with Frank, and during the interview, Frank said, comic books and movies are getting married. And, you know, they really are. You know, films have always used storyboards in pre-production in one way or the other to sort of communicate what they were going to do. And if you have a comic book that you're going to turn into a movie, a lot of that work is already done. A lot of the heavy lifting, anyway.
I think one of the things that Frank Miller, in addition to his love of comics, is his kindredship with other comic creators and their love of the medium.
He's probably more more aware of what's going on in like small press and stuff than people would ever imagine. He's very, in his own words, very excited about what he sees at, like, SPX and stuff like that because of the new generation of comic creators that are coming out. So I know he's very much involved with the world of comics still.
Sure, and it's great to hear about creators meeting idols, and here is
like when Scotty Young met me.
Yeah,
his idol.
Scotty met you. Here is Andy Park's recounting of meeting Frank Miller.
He was standing at a party in San Diego, and Phil and I were kind of getting ready to leave, and I said, "Screw that! I'm going to go meet Frank Miller." And Shrek was standing nearby, and Bob said, "I'll go introduce you." And God bless him. I must have babbled incoherent. I mean, I think I managed to say, "Your work means a lot to me," and blah, blah, blah. And God bless him. He said he liked Green Arrow. He said, "You guys fucking get it, man, because you're cartoonists." And I don't think my feet hit the ground the rest of the night. Phil and I skipped home to our hotel like little girls. It was amazing. And I still haven't gotten over that moment. There are a lot of guys in this business that I revere that much, but I never met most of them. Kurtzman, Kirby, guys like that, and I never got to meet him. So Frank is like the story of the guy I worshipped and I got to meet, and he was cool to me. And you can't beat that.
I hope someday to meet him. I missed him last year.
Yeah, but he still won't know who you are.
Yeah, he won't. No fucking idea who I am.
With Andy, and he had actually mentioned this, many, many episodes ago. Whenever we talked with Andy, that he has I think several bookshelves of comics and collected editions and reference material. But there's one small bookshelf that he keeps by his drafting table in his studio, and it's filled with Frank Miller work. So I know that that he has been a huge influence on Andy and Andy's comics career.
I think he's been, you know, an enormous influence on just, you know, a ton of people. I mean, I think you see it everywhere. And for him to, you know, to hear Andy talk about, you know, a guy like that is cool, because it's like, you know, and I know what we're like when we meet guys like Andy and Phil, or you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, we're, you know, we turn into babbling, you know, let alone someone like Frank Miller, that I probably wouldn't, you know what to say to a guy like that, but I would love to meet him someday. I missed him last year at Wizard World Chicago by like 45 minutes, but maybe sometime.
Maybe one of these days, huh?
Yep, maybe we can get him on the show somehow, some way. If anybody out there knows Frank Miller and likes us, tell him to come on our show.
Well,
yeah, well, it's two things. If you know Frank and you like us, that's not going to be a lot of people, but maybe somebody out there.
Well, I think a really good way to wrap this up. It's it was kind of fun riding along with John Byrne, walking through Frank's career. And
this is your life, according to John Byrne.
I know, and he was so gracious to.
Thank you to all the guys, Jerry and Andy and especially John for you know, spending time with us and giving their insight on Frank. And it's great to hear you know, a guy like John Byrne talk about Frank and
the respect,
yeah,
that and just mutual admiration. I think it's very apt for us to leave the discussion with another clip from John Byrne talking about Frank Miller and where we're going to go now.
Frank has such a great love of comics. Just the medium. When you talk to him, that shines through. That you know, he may have outgrown or passed beyond superheroes, but he loves comics. And I the Frank Miller I think I know, I don't think could ever completely walk away from it any more than I could. I mean, I'm still happily doing superheroes, but I think Frank will always have at least one toe in that, and every once in a while he'll say, "Oh, I'm going to do a
a 900-page, you know, Life of Mozart just to, you know, blow everybody's minds. And he will, you know.
And there you go. That is our creator spotlight on Frank Miller. So hope you enjoyed that. I think that will just be the first of many creator spotlights that we do. I know I had a lot of fun putting that together, and I know you've been looking forward to talking about Frank all week long.
Yeah, I mean, if there's one guy that I probably admire in the industry more than any, it's Frank Miller. He's my favorite creator, favorite writer, favorite artist. I think a guy who's, you know, broke more barriers and has just done just an amazing amount of work. As much as I love Alan Moore's stuff, he's no artist. And Frank's done it both. And not to, you know, I mean...
And done both really
and
well.
And done both extremely well and you know, and just done stuff that is redefining of the industry over and over and over again.
You look, you know, comics, I'm a fan of jazz, baseball, and comics, and all three of those things are uniquely American in their...
I like popsicles.
In their origins, and I think that that Frank Miller is one of the great...
Baseball is not uniquely American.
Yes, it is.
It is not.
Yes, it is.
You're crazy.
Give me that... To all our listeners in the UK, don't give me that rounders crap.
No, it didn't start. It didn't have any other.
I think he's one of the great American creators in a
purely American art form. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, in an art form.
He's a true American, a true patriot.
Mm-hmm. You know what I'm trying to say there?
No, I think I understand what you mean. He
you know, comics are a true American art form. They were made here. They were pioneered here, and I think he's one of the
I think he personifies. And we could get into this some other time, but I think what I take from that is like he personifies the sort of American that American spirit in an American art form.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? As much as we love the British writers and the British, and even a lot of other American, I mean, it's that rebel, that maverick that Frank Miller is, that makes him very much American.
There was a great British invasion in comics, and we saw some of the greatest comics that have ever been produced that... We're done by these very talented writers and artists that came from Great Britain, and Frank Miller was like that one flagpole in that era.
Right. It's like, okay, these guys have just kicked our asses everywhere,
mm-hmm.
but we still got Frank.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We got him at least. You know, it's like you might have Alan Moore and Grant Morrison and all these guys, but we still got Frank. You know, and yeah, I can see what you mean by that. It's like the as an American, and you do take some, I guess, additional pride in the fact that, you know, he's one of us.
Yeah,
but it's just an amazing creative force in comics that you know, and while he's moving on to film, I think we'll see some amazing stuff there too. And I don't think he's done in comics.
I don't think he'll ever be done in comics. Not all the way. All right, well, everyone...
But I am. I'm done with comics.
We're done with comics for the night.
Oh.
So I tell you what, let's remind folks a few different ways that they can interact with the show. One of my favorites is by leaving us an iTunes music
review.
Tell
us how wonderful we are.
You can.
Because we're very insecure.
You could do that at the iTunes music store. And I'd like to give special thanks to Clark147, Professor Mullins, and it's SCAD. Thank you, Jeremy.
He's everywhere.
Bottle City and Josh Shipp.
Not chippy. Make sure to check out all the great things that AroundComics.com has to offer. It's your source for the best in comic book news, reviews, and opinions. We post the next week's topic on Tuesdays at our forum at AroundComics.com.
And you can...
And next week is David Peterson of Mouse Guard fame.
Absolutely. We are proud members of the Comics Podcast Network. You can find more great podcasts at ComicsPodcasts.com.
And thank you again to InStock Trades for sponsoring this episode. InStockTrades.com is your source for all things Frank Miller. Check out Frank Miller's landmark run on Daredevil in the Daredevil Omnibus, which I highly recommend. They also carry Batman, The Dark Knight Returns, The Dark Knight Strikes Again, Ronin, Sin City, and many others. InStockTrades.com is your source for trade paperbacks, deluxe hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at great discounted prices. And remember that all orders over $50 ship for free.
A Dark Knight Absolute Edition is
awesome. I've bought that, like you said, like five different times. And I bought the Daredevil. I own all the Daredevil, Frank Miller Daredevil issues, but I bought the omnibus anyway.
You're sick.
I am. I know.
Don't forget about our Be a Hero contest. Make a donation at www.heroinitiative.org and help veteran creators in need. Then send us an email at hero@aroundcomics.com letting us know that you did it. Everyone that makes a donation is entered into a drawing that will take place at the end of June. The contest is being sponsored by InStockTrades.com. They're including $100 in gift certificates, good for anything that they carry. In addition to a $50 gift certificate, the first place winner will receive a prize pack including a one-of-a-kind hardcover edition of Jeffrey Brown's I'm Going to Be Small, an autographed Scotty Young sketchbook, and a Mike Norton Fallen Son edition Captain America sketch. All that and more. Second prize is a
swift kick in the
The second prize is a $50 gift certificate to InStockTrades.com. So donate at HeroInitiative.org, then email us at hero@aroundcomics.com. All entries need to be in by June 30th.
And special thanks to everyone who's donated so far, including our latest donators. I like it's like a supervillain. And the donator. Zach Enhert, I don't know how to pronounce your last name, Zach. It's Zach Enhert.
Zach Enhert.
And Josh Shipp. Thank you both.
I'd like to thank everyone that was a part of this episode.
Doom. John Doom. Byrne. Who would win in a fight, John Byrne or Doom?
John Byrne would disintegrate Doom with his eyes.
Cool. I agree.
Jerry Duggan, thank you so much. Andy Parks, always,
my man.
Always a pleasure.
My brother
to Mr.
from
Parks.
Another mother.
Thanks to Mark, as always, for hosting us here at Dark Tower. Tom will be back again on next Monday's episode. Scotty will be back from Heroes Con. It depends. I don't know if Tom will be back. It depends on if he's back from Special Assignment or not.
Special Assignment. He's assassinating someone. That's his special assignment.
So, Sal and I will be back on Monday.
I won't be here.
Are you taking the week
off?
Yeah,
I'm taking off.
Your turn now?
Yeah. You guys all have taken time off. You, Tom, Scotty.
I'm here for at least
I'm always time. Here.
I know.
You guys suck. I'm gone.
Well, we'll be back on Monday.
I'm not coming
about
back.
All of the news and new releases. In the meantime.
In between time.
We'll be everywhere in.
And around comics.
I miss Tom's snappy little quotes here now.
Yeah, I got nothing.
Would like to suggest a topic? Send us your comments or are interested in becoming a panel member? Email us at info@aroundcomics.com or visit the Contact Us section of our website. Music for the show provided by the Podshow Podsafe Music Network. Music.podshow.com. Views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and do not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Thank you for listening today and remember to join us next time when the panel will change but our mission will stay the same. Bringing you the very best news, reviews, and opinions in and around comics. Around Comics is a Pipe Dream production. Copyright 2007, all rights reserved. Love you, babe. Yeah. Why you got my love and left me alone? Why you got my love alone? I know that you don't love me. Baby, love you one more time.